WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Jennifer Jason Leigh is known for portraying over-the-edge characters. A prostitute in Last Exit to Brooklyn, a psychopathic killer roommate in Single White Female, a heroin-addicted punk rocker in Georgia. She's won the Best Actress Award from the National Society of Film Critics and the New York Film Critics Circle. Now she's starring in two literary adaptations. She plays one of the three sisters in 1,000 Acres, based on Jane Smiley's novel, which is a contemporary reworking of King Lear. And Leigh is starring in a new adaptation of the Henry James novella, Washington Square. Written in 1880 and set in New York, it's the story of a shy, plain, and not terribly interesting young woman, Catherine, who is the heir to a fortune. When a handsome, young, but broke suitor asks to marry her, she believes she's found her true love, but her father is convinced it's the money the young man is after. The father, portrayed in the film by Albert Finney, forces his daughter to choose between him and the young man, and between money and love. Washington Square was also the basis of the 1949 film The Heiress, which starred Olivia de Havilland and Montgomery Clift. I asked Jennifer Jason Leigh if there were lines in the Henry James novella that were particularly helpful in developing her character. She read me a passage.
"And if the delightful custom of her lover's visage, which yielded her a happiness in which confidence and timidity were strangely blended, had suddenly come to an end, she would not only not have spoken of herself as one of the forsaken, but she would not have thought of herself as one of the disappointed."
I think one of the things that's really key in that line is her blend of confidence and timidity.
Mm-hmm, exactly. And the confidence that it slowly comes to her, because this is someone who had no confidence, and once in love, she's able to bloom and find herself. And once in love, when she looks in the mirror, she doesn't see this ugly creature any longer who's always disappointing. She sees herself anew, as it were. And as you do when you fall in love, suddenly there is ground under your feet, and it's just the most beautiful feeling in the world. And with Catherine, the way that James describes her, she always thought it would be this passionate, quick feeling of constant energy, and yet what he writes when she's in love is that it gives her all the patience in the world, because suddenly she's fulfilled in a way that is almost includes a kind of sacrifice, because she can live from day to day or week to month just on the one visit and the knowledge that he said, "I will see you again." And I think I was certainly like that. And I know a lot of women who were. I mean, I remember the first crush I had, and I couldn't even call that love, but it was with I was 16, and it was with a waiter, and he would say things like, "Take it easy," and I would think about it for hours, you know, really, or "See you later," and just the fact that there was hope in that, you know, that he might actually want to see me later. You could live on things like that. So I certainly understand. I mean, James just writes it in a much more beautiful way, but the feelings are timeless.
Had he singled you out at a table he was waiting on?
Oh, me and my girlfriends would just go and sit at his table for hours, night after night. We were, you know, like silly girls, and he was the man.
Now, let me get back to Henry James. A couple of other descriptions that I'd like to read from the book. And this is her father, the character's father, thinking about her. He thinks, "Poor Catherine was not defiant. She had no genius for bravado." And later on, James describes her as, you know, a dull, plain girl, she was called by rigorous critics, a quiet, ladylike girl by those of the more imaginative sort. But by neither class was she very elaborately discussed. So here's somebody who starts off kind of invisible, kind mm-hmm. of unable to assert herself into the world in any way. And later she gets the kind of strength that is, in a way, also invisible. You know, mm-hmm. it's such a kind of quiet,
it's a quiet
hidden
strength.
So tell me about playing all these traits that are so hidden.
Well, in a sense, that was the easy part, because that's the part I understand. That's the part that's closest to home. And for me, in playing Catherine, those were the qualities which I I really do. I do understand because I possess them. I am quiet by nature. I am shy by nature. I am socially awkward, and it's hard for me to articulate what I feel and to express myself in a way that feels natural. And so I loved her journey in this and her arc, because what happens is she comes to accept her awkwardness, as it were, and her silence, and accept them as her strengths. And so that's nice.
This is a period piece. You're wearing period clothes, 19th century, set in New York. And let me read again something from Henry James. And this is him describing her sense of clothing, her sense of style. He writes, "Our heroine was 20 years old before she treated herself for evening wear to a red satin gown trimmed with gold fringe, though this was an article which for many years she had coveted in secret. It made her look, when she sported it, like a woman of 30, but oddly enough, in spite of her taste for fine clothes, she had not a grain of coquetry, and her anxiety when she put them on was as to whether they, and not she, would look well." Tell me how you wore these clothes and what you tried to convey in them.
Well, being an inarticulate girl, I think she uses clothes as a means to express herself. And she has so much to say, and she wants to say it in the most grand, beautiful, expressive way. And of course, she chooses everything wrong. I mean, but it's her way of communicating something. The clothes were incredibly awkward, and the corsets were extremely uncomfortable.
Did you have to wear corsets for the role?
Absolutely, yeah. The clothes won't fit without the corsets. And the thing of it is, I also, of course, did a lot of research about corsetry and the medical journals about the dangers of too tight lacing. And it's pretty fascinating. I mean, what it does is they put the waist at your floating rib, which, you know, they made my waist to 19 inches. And so everything is compressed and all your internal organs are pushed down. And some of these women, their livers would be pushed so far back that they would have the impression of the stays in them. Women wore organ stoppers, which looked like diaphragms, because sometimes their organs would come out of their bodies. They would die from having their lungs punctured by their ribs. The ribs would grow extra cartilage and become connected to the breastbone. So, I mean, you can only imagine what life was like back then. And when you also think that you couldn't dress yourself as a woman if you had money, because all your dresses laced in the back and buttoned in the back. And when you think about that for even a short period of time, you realize how just how imprisoned you would feel in your life, in everyday life, not being able to simply dress yourself. No freedom, no independence whatsoever.
Because this is set in 19th century New York, were there certain contemporary mannerisms that you had to get rid of? Mannerisms of your own that you really had to banish because they were just so inappropriate for the period?
Well, there were a lot of I found a lot of etiquette books on the period, which were very, very helpful to me. Most of the mannerisms that I had to get rid of were speech mannerisms. So I worked with a dialect coach. And we actually all had to work with a dialect coach because Judith Ivy and I, we were the only Americans in the cast, but we were all supposed to be American. So, but, you know, in the 1850s, the speech was more mid-Atlantic, they call it. So we all sort of worked together on that. And, yeah, you know, women weren't supposed to express their emotions. That wasn't correct behavior, so to speak, you know. You weren't supposed to touch your face very often. But Catherine fails at all these things because she's without artifice. I really loved learning the etiquette, the language of the glove, of the fan, of the parasol. Which can be quite confusing because they all, you know, one book defines it one way, another book defines it another way.
Jennifer Jason Lee is my guest, and she's starring in the new film adaptation of the Henry James novella Washington Square. Let's take a short break, and then we'll talk some more.
Okay.
This is Fresh Air. Back with Jennifer Jason Leigh. She's starring in a film adaptation of the Henry James novella Washington Square. And she also stars in the adaptation of Jane Smiley's novel, A Thousand Acres. Let me ask you about A Thousand Acres. Like Washington Square, it's based on a book. So this is like two movies in a row where you had to, you know, go through the book as well as the screenplay. So has that opened up a new dimension to you? I mean, to have so much book to fall back on. I mean, to
yeah, it's lovely. Yeah. It helps a lot because you don't have to invent as much. There's so much of the inner life of the character right there for you to read and to understand, and you know. They're great writers, so it's a pleasure also to read. And when I was doing A Thousand Acres, I went on kind of a Jane Smiley binge.
Right.
And read everything, I think. So that was a lot of fun.
Now, in A Thousand Acres, Jason Robards plays your father. And I know that he was a longtime friend of the family's. In fact, when you took a stage name, the Jennifer Jason Leigh, the Jason is from Jason Robards.
Yeah. So it was great working with him.
Well,
and
I was really wondering about that, though, because I know, let me tell you that when I find it very difficult sometimes to interview somebody I know well, to interview a friend. And I was wondering if there was any kind of similar difficulty you felt acting with somebody who you know really well and who you're really close with.
You know, it's not, it's almost the opposite because the more comfortable you are with someone, the easier acting with them is, I think. And also, it was very easy for me to believe Jason was my dad because I think of him in such a paternal way.
Mm-hmm.
And I've always admired him so much and just felt so much love for him that it was great to pretend to be his daughter for a little while. You know, he's a great man and, you know, obviously a great actor. And, yeah. I just love him, and I am so happy that I got to work with him.
You know, it seems to me that in spite of now playing the very kind of subtle characters that Jane Smiley and Henry James have written, that in a lot of ways you've really specialized in extremes, in playing prostitutes and punk rockers and people who are really on the edge.
Mm-hmm.
And even in Washington Square, it's an extreme. It's an extremely inhibited character.
Right.
And I'm wondering why you gravitate to extremes.
I think because, I mean, in a very simple way, they're just the most exciting characters to play. And they give you, they're the most challenging and the farthest reaching, really. And you're communicating something that is outside most people's experience, and yet trying to illuminate that person. And sometimes it's a person that we might not otherwise really take more than a, you know, casual glance at and then be thankful we're not that person. So it's a way of, they're characters that I find moving for whatever reason.
You said that growing up, you were the good girl. It was your sister who was the extrovert, the one kicked out of school, the one who joined the carnival, the one who had a drug habit for a few years. Are there characters you understood through knowing your sister?
I think so, and I think it was also a way to understand my sister.
Mm-hmm. By kind of playing her out in these roles?
Mm-hmm, exactly. And a way of trying to understand and get closer to her, because in playing a lot of them, I would call her up. And so adults, that's almost how we became friends again. And there was always something, a little bit of, in a strange way, hero worship with my sister, even though, you know, she was sort of the black sheep and getting into trouble left and right. But I admired her courage, I think, even though I don't think it was the healthiest existence. I admired her daring to go and live out where most of us never would dare to go or want to go.
So she lived on the edge through her actions, and you lived on the edge through your acting.
Yeah. I lived on the edge in a very safe way.
You know, in the movie Georgia, the movie was written by your mother. Yeah. And was about two sisters. One sister is a very sensitive folk rock singer. You played the sister who was the punk rocker, the sister who was on the edge, the sister who developed a drug habit. You played someone who is passionate about singing but doesn't have an inherently beautiful voice.
Mm-hmm.
What she does have is a lot of attitude and a lot of passion on stage. How did you handle the singing part so that you would get all that across?
Well, I love to sing, but I wasn't gifted. You know, I wasn't blessed with a very good voice at all, and so it wasn't so hard. I just sang out, Louise, and I had a great time. I must say, just to be that free and that alive and that out there. And not to care what you sounded like, but to be, Sadie is so in love with singing and so in love with being in front of an audience and exposing herself, really. Because when she sings, she's very naked and it's very raw. And so it was scary, but it was thrilling at the same time. So, and I didn't have to worry about trying to sing badly or trying to sing well. It was just about the experience of singing, you know?
Of really being out there.
Mm-hmm.
Let me play your performance from the movie of a Van Morrison song. And this is just a real showpiece in the movie because you're so on the edge with this. So let's hear some.
Okay.
I've been walking by the river. I've been walking down by the water. Walking down by the river.
This must have been so out there for you because you always describe yourself as in reality being a very inhibited person.
Yeah, but that's why I love acting. So when I was playing Sadie, I had the time of my life, really.
Yeah.
I mean, that night was scary and for a number of reasons. There were 3,000 people there. It's definitely the biggest night of Sadie's life, and it would be also one of the biggest nights of my life. We didn't have any money making that film, so the way we got people there was by getting local bands to play, and then we'd shoot in between the local bands. There was so much adrenaline pumping through my body that, I mean, for days afterwards, I just felt exhausted, like a zombie. All of us, I think, actually, because there was a lot of pressure to get it all done in one night, and then it's Sadie's trying to, you know, pay homage to Van Morrison, so I really wanted to get every nuance down. But the thing about Sadie is the more she tries to be someone else, the more Sadie she becomes, and the
right.
more Sadie comes through. And so, I mean, when I was doing it, I thought I was Van Morrison, and then I heard it back, and no, it was Sadie.
You said something that I think is so true about this character you wrote. There's always been something beautiful to you about someone who dreams about something, desperately wants it, but has no talent for it.
Mm-hmm.
Like how this character desperately wants to be a great singer, but isn't, you know, inherently blessed with what we'd consider a beautiful voice. Although, again, you know, she just has this stage presence. But how did you understand that? Because, I mean, you have the gift for acting. Is there something you've desperately wanted to do but felt untalented enough to do well?
Oh, yeah. I mean, so many things. For example, singing is an example. Everyone in my family has a very, very beautiful voice. In fact, Carrie, my older sister, who has a lot of elements of Sadie, has a voice like Joplin, seriously like Joplin. And it's a powerhouse, and it's beautiful and amazing to listen to. My little sister, Mina, has an incredibly beautiful, melodic, full voice. My mom has a great voice, everyone. And I have this weak, tinny, you know, nothing voice, and then but I like to sing really loud, and then it just sounds horrible. So that's certainly one thing. And of course, when I see it in people who have a love of something that they have no talent for, but they've decided to make that their profession, then that's really sad to me, and really beautiful, though, the yearning for that. And I think that's something that we all, I think, can understand to a degree, because we all have that in us. I mean, when we read a beautiful poem or hear a piece of music, and we just, you know, it makes you think there is God, that God touched this person, and how grateful you are to be able to hear it, but the yearning and the knowledge that you could never produce that, I think is something we all can understand.
Jennifer Jason Leigh will be back in the second half of the show. She's starring in Washington Square and The Thousand Acres. This is Fresh Air. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with Jennifer Jason Leigh. She's now starring in A Thousand Acres, based on the Jane Smiley novel, and Washington Square, based on the Henry James novella. Her mother, Barbara Turner, is a screenwriter. She wrote the screenplay for Georgia, in which Jennifer Jason Leigh played a punk rocker with more passion than talent. When you were a girl, how much did you get to see of your mother's screenwriting career?
Oh, everything. I mean, when I was very, very young, I was reading her screenplays, which made me feel rather proud, I think. The fact that she would let me read them, and then she would actually say, "What do you think?" So from a very young age, I felt that my thoughts or my ideas about things had some validity, or there was a place for them to be heard.
I know you don't like to talk about your father, but I just have one question. Your father was the actor Vic Morrow, and I know your parents were separated when you were two. And I'm wondering what it was like to know him maybe primarily through television. I don't know if Combat was on when you were young, if you saw reruns of it, but it must have been unusual to see your father through roles and not have a lot of contact with him in life.
Well, Combat was actually when I was very, very young. So I do have memories, even though I was two, of watching Combat and absolutely loving it. I have a bunch of those on tape, actually. My favorite movie was Blackboard Jungle that he made, and that was made before I was born. So, but, you know, I knew my father growing up. It wasn't as though I didn't know him.
Uh-huh. You dropped out of high school about 6 weeks before graduation to take
right.
an acting role. What was the role, and why were you willing to drop out for it?
I was, like, desperate for any reason to drop out of high school, actually.
Did you hate it?
I did.
For social reasons or for more
no,
academic
I
reasons?
No, I had great, great friends. I mean, great friends who are still my great friends. I mean, I have friends from two because I grew up in L.A. And a lot of them we had all gone to Oakwood, which is a small, private, very liberal school in Los Angeles. And then they suddenly in 10th grade decided to go to a public school in the Palisades. I didn't live in the Palisades, so I became an emancipated minor and used a false address so that I could go to school just to be with my friends, which basically meant being an emancipated minor that I could write my own notes. And so I frequently went to school, met my friends, and then went to Westwood, which was the place where all the movie theaters were, and went to movies all day. So I didn't really go to school a lot in 11th and 12th grade. And I wanted to act. That's all I wanted to do, really. And I was, you know, bored and restless and just not really inspired. But unfortunately, there are things I regret about, not really about leaving high school. I only had 6 weeks left, and I still didn't know anything about American government. But the great thing about acting for me is that I do so much research. And so every time I have a role, I learn so much about subjects I had no knowledge about
right.
before.
I think in some ways your acting school was the early horror movies that that you made.
Yeah, the first movie was a B horror film where I played a blind, deaf and dumb girl who is hysterically blind, deaf and dumb. Because of a rape when she was a child, and then there's an attempted rape at the end of the movie, and she gets all her senses back. So,
What are some of the various ways you've been killed or mutilated in movies over the years?
Gosh, I don't think I've been killed that many times, actually. I think just,
Last Exit to Brooklyn?
She doesn't die.
You don't think she dies in that?
I don't think so.
Okay.
No, she doesn't. I don't think so. I don't think she dies in the book. You just sort of leave her in a bloody mess, but I don't think
after
she
being
dies.
Gang raped and
gang banged, yeah.
Yeah. And then in the Hitcher,
you're
dismembered
definitely.
By trucks. Your yeah. limbs are tied to trucks heading in opposite directions. This was were you ever actually tied to the trucks?
I was, but the trucks didn't move. They said the trucks were just going to move 2 inches, and did I want to try it first, or did I want to see the stunt double try it first? And I'm kind of safety conscious, and so I asked to see the stunt double try it first, and the trucks moved about 3 feet because they're very heavy trucks, and you can't really control how little they move. And so, you know, she was a very sturdy girl. Thank God. But it was a little frightening to watch.
In another horror film, or thriller, I should say, that you made, Single White Female.
I died in that.
Yeah, you died in that one, too. Right. Though it took a really long time to kill you. You
right.
kept coming back for more in that thriller kind of way. You play a character who answers a personal ad for a roommate. And your roommate is played by Bridget Fonda. So you move in with Bridget Fonda and then obsessively try to become her in every way, to get her hairdo and her manner and her clothes. And it's clear that you are, you know, something of a psychopath in it. And, mm-hmm. and then you become murderous. It must really be interesting to take on the traits of the character, you know, of the actress who you're playing opposite. Basically, to become Bridget Fonda in it. And I thought you were very convincing in doing that.
Oh, thanks. That was a really fun fun part. I mean, it was just so... I mean, psychologically, it was just very, very interesting, just the desire to merge. I mean, it really is a kind of merging and the feeling that without the other, you are not whole. And so I did a lot of just research into borderline personality. And I was able to interview some twins who had been hospitalized for that, exactly. And it really is this feeling that someone else is responsible for your happiness. And so, therefore, you know, there's just the qualities of envy and all of that, that come into play, where this person is responsible for your happiness, therefore they can take it away, and that can be very threatening.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's not only that she wants to be like Bridget's character, she wants them to merge and be one. And
right.
so at a certain point, she feels she's more her than Bridget's character. you know, in a certain way, that she has become her and they are one, but she definitely can't live without the other.
Do you think that your mother taught you how to read between the lines in a screenplay?
Well, I think what was great about having a mother that is a writer is, first of all, she's incredibly dedicated to her work, and she just, I think, for a woman, a girl growing up, seeing your mother working and seeing her in love with what she does and working sometimes 18, 20-hour days and having a tremendous passion about what she does and fighting for what she believes in and being absolutely uncompromising. And that's where I learned research from. I mean, she makes my research look like it's nothing. She's practically fanatical about it. And I feel really fortunate for that. It just showed me that women, I mean, I never thought there was an inequality between men and women because my mother worked, and she worked really, really hard, and she was great at what she did. And it also spoiled me in terms of reading screenplays because she's a great writer. And I love reading her scripts so much. And so I got, that kind of spoiled me because a lot of scripts aren't very good, you know?
Right. What are you working on now? What's your next movie?
I'm going to go work with David Cronenberg,
who
I've always wanted to work with.
Oh, great.
So I'm so excited.
What's the movie?
It's called Existenz.
As in existential?
Sort of.
Well, he's a great director, so that should be really interesting.
Yeah, he is great.
Well, I want to thank you so much for talking with us. Thank you.
Thank you. It was my pleasure.
Jennifer Jason Leigh is starring in Washington Square and 1,000 Acres.